Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, teaching you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with us today, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, noted psychiatrist, jazz guy, and interviewer. Budding interviewer, eh?
Fellow interviewer.
Hey, fellow interviewer. And also with us today, this is really fascinating, Franz Johansson. Through the good work of Jana, who does our research, Jana was able to dig up, and she said, what's the most interesting thing out there, effect? And we ran into an author, Franz Johansson, who is stationed right here in New York, lives right here in New York, who wrote a book, and the book is called The Medici Effect. And the Medici Effect is kind of fascinating for you to learn about, because we teach everything Italian here at WBAI 99.5. What is the Medici Effect? Franz, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you, Armand. It is really the way we can change our life, the way we can change the world. The Medici Effect refers to what happens when we combine ideas from different industries, different fields, different cultures, and when we connect those different ideas to create something new. Just the way the Medicis encouraged it back in the Renaissance 500 years ago.
Well, take us back there a little bit for them who don't know the Medicis.
Sure.
There's Joe Medici and Larry Medici. Who are the Medicis?
The Medicis was this banking family that essentially ruled the city of Florence about 500 years ago in Italy. And they sponsored creative individuals, you know, architects, sculptors, painters, philosophers, mathematicians. Leonardo da Vinci is one of the most famous individuals that they sponsored from all over Europe, even as far away as from China. And they brought them to the city of Florence, where these people were able to break down the boundaries between the different disciplines, between the different cultures, and ignite what became one of the most creative eras in Europe's history, the Renaissance. And I was curious, how can we create the same effect in our own lives or the organizations that we work for? And in the course of the...
So you're saying the Medicis, by pulling together in Florence, around what time was this?
It was about 500 years ago.
500 years ago, the Medicis said, let's get one from column A and one from column B. Let's bring in that Chinese architect. Let's bring in that French guy. Let's bring in that Italian guy. Let's bring in these different people. Let's bring them in because that person's doing something great.
Well, and it wasn't as much by design to bring together these different people in order to create something great. They went out and they looked for great people from all over the world, really. And in addition, because of what Florence became, great people saw themselves being attracted to Florence. And they were able to do that because the Medici family sponsored them. So they were able to actually, it was through their sponsorship that they were able to bring together these different perspectives.
Didn't Mozart live right outside of Florence? I think I went to a house that Mozart lived in.
Vienna,
but I remember, it'll come to me.
Yeah. It's possible.
But it is true that Michelangelo, right?
Came out,
I believe, when he was 12, 13, 14. He was taken into this already thriving community, and that's where he learned his chops.
That's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. So when people think of the Medici Effect, they think of banking, they think of money, they think of creativity. What is the Medici?
So what I talk about in the book, actually, is not necessarily banking. It is how do we come up with new ideas and how do we make those ideas happen? Let me give you an example. One of the first stories in my book, The Medici Effect, is of an architect who got this challenge. He had to build the largest building in Harare, Zimbabwe. But this building was to contain no air conditioning, which is it's an intriguing challenge. You can get kind of hot in Harare, Zimbabwe on occasion.
Where is this place?
So this is the capital.
In Zimbabwe?
Yeah, in Zimbabwe.
Okay.
And so he has to build this building, the largest building, without any air conditioning. Now, but he succeeded in doing that. And the reason he succeeded in doing that was because he decided to look at how termites build their hills, their mounds, on the African savanna. They can build these mounds, and in the mounds they have to keep an exact 87 degrees Fahrenheit. in order to grow this fungi that helps them digest wood. And he looked at the way they did that through complicated system of ventilation shafts. And he said, I can use that exact same methodology for my building, which is what he did. So now he combined these two different fields, architecture and termite ecology, and created something groundbreaking, a building that you needed no AC, that saved them $4 million, and uses about 90% less energy than the other building around it.
Hmm. Pretty remarkable. And it is remarkable. That's just using you're using your noggin because you're looking over at one thing. But is there something that happens when a number of these different disciplines intersect?
What actually happens is two things. The first one is that when you step into the intersection of these different disciplines, you get access to widely different ideas. So designers at Nike work together with engineers at General Motors and come up with new interesting car designs. But on top of that, you come up with so many more ideas. It is a true explosion of ideas.
My guest is Franz Johansson. We're talking about the book, The Medici Effect. Franz, I want to go back for a second, just a word. The word intersection means a lot to you. So it's a capital I intersection. It's not just small I intersection. What is an intersection?
The intersection is that place that connects different cultures, that connects different fields, that connects different industries. It is, when we think of an intersection, we often think of a physical place, you know, two roads that intersect, 6th Avenue and 57th Street, for instance, right outside of here. The intersection I talk about is really in the mind. It is the place where different people can come together, or in your own mind, you bring these different notions together, these different ideas, architecture and termite ecology, they intersect.
Yeah, you talk about like directional kind of creativity and directional innovation, which is already difficult enough. A lot of the shows we've talked about that the idea of breaking out of old ways of thinking of things and taking risks and thinking creatively directionally is difficult enough. But what you're talking about is not just that. It's getting out of your comfort zone of the field that maybe you know something about or have an expertise about, and using other divergent fields to get ideas and to explore.
The reason why we think of that as difficult to step into the intersection is because, exactly what you said, we have to step out of our comfort zone. Interestingly enough, though, stepping into the intersection of different fields or cultures is the single best way we have of generating high-level success. Mm-hmm. It is the easiest way of doing it. If you're in a directional field, you can certainly become the cutting-edge person in that area. But the problem is, in order to do that, you have to be number one. You have to be the fastest, the smartest, the bestest person, mm-hmm. which leaves very little room for anybody else. And on top of that, everybody else that is hunting you for that spot knows exactly where you're going. It's so directional. If you're in the technology industry, you developed a 20-gig hard drive, you know a 30-gig is coming. I mean, this is not brain science. When you step into the intersection, what you really do is you look at what do you know today. You look at your experience. You look at your network, your colleagues, everything that defines you. And you say, what would happen if I take that and combine it with an idea from a different industry or a different field or a different culture? And when you do that, you can just break out and create tremendous success. And hopefully later today we can talk about some people that have done that.
You know, one of the we're speaking with Franz Johansson. One of the things, I'm just trying to get a picture now. Let's say you're a book designer and you design book covers. And that's what you do, and you're the head book designer of... It's like one thing you could do is use all your skills as a book designer because you know how to design covers, you have colors, you have fonts, you have different things that you could use, but it's all set. But meanwhile, something sitting right there on your way home, something in the sand may alert you to something new. And every now and then you see these books coming out that have something unusual on it, like a plastic cover over a bunch of sand or something, to create something different. So I think you're saying that you have to kind of go outside the box.
That's right. And not just go outside of your box, but also peek into someone inside somebody else's box and see if we can combine those different ideas.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, later on in the book, you're talking about, you know, even ways to try to challenge yourself, or like mind games or games to sort of, you know, get yourself to think creatively and get yourself to think out of the box, and sort of like book cover internet or book cover coffee, or just combining those two things that are kind of automatically not associated, but then forcing yourself, it seems like, to think about that will get associations and divergent thinking and all sorts of interesting things where you actually find something about coffee covers or book covers and coffee that may have some innovative idea.
One of the easiest things that anyone can do, anybody who's listening to this can do within a couple of minutes, is literally to go into a newsstand and pick out a magazine that you would never, ever read. Okay, you're not interested in horseback riding? Well, pick out a magazine on horseback riding or whatever, skiing, fishing. And then take that magazine and look at the stories, look at the ideas, look at the images, and try to connect that to what it is that you're doing right now. Most likely, you're going to come up with something different. Now, it may be very different, and you don't know what to do with it. That's fine. But sometimes, you'll come up with an idea that goes, this is just right. This is exactly what I should be doing.
You know, I was recently taken by, you know who Cesar Millan is? He's the dog whisperer. He's a dog trainer who's on television. And nothing I would ever see, nothing I would ever watch, dog trainer. And I learned so much about our field. I learned so much about psychotherapy and psychology from seeing that. And then we go beyond that to hobbies. Sometimes people have really unusual hobbies. And you can't imagine connecting. Like, imagine a shrink who is a wine hobbyist. You know, how do these things connect? How do you connect your hobbies to your profession? Sometimes they seem so separate, and I think you're saying that there's always a connection, Franz. If you're the thing in the middle, there's a connection between your hobby, probably a connection between even your fetishes. You know, probably no matter where you go, there's some major theme that holds true, a thread. Is that true?
I believe that virtually everything in this world is connected one way or another. The challenge for us is trying to figure out how, and how to make those connections come to life. And what you said about hobbies is certainly true. One of the other stories in the book is of Richard Garfield, who invented the game Magic, and also the spawner of that game. Anyone who's a recent parent will know the Pokemon card game, collectible card game that kids all over the world started trading incessantly. At any rate, how did he come up with this remarkable game? You know, game was his hobby. He was a mathematics teacher in Seattle, and he was interested in games. And ultimately, what he managed to do was connect the mathematics notion of how magic works, along with a card game and collectible items. And when he did that, that combination, particularly the collectible item notion of these card games, was something that was new, the world had never seen before, and within a year generated over $40 million in revenue. It was a tremendous success, but it was because he dared to explore this connection with his hobby.
But I can't imagine, friends, that somebody who has no sense of organization, who is a scatterbrain, who has scattered thinking everywhere, but never has a sense of pulling anything together, can suddenly wind up pulling it together. I mean, what do you have? Do you have one of these pages where if you eat the corner of the page, it suddenly makes you creative?
It's in the water.
In the 60s, we used to have that.
It's in Kool-Aid, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the thing.
If you're not organized, you say take all your elements, right? And many people could take, the way I am here and the way I am there and my interest there and my interest there. And I have 1,000 interests. I have one cousin, a young guy, who has more interests than anybody you could ever imagine. And he can't get his life in order.
The definition of innovation is to take a creative idea and to make it happen. So, in other words, you can have the most creative person on the planet, but if this person hasn't been able to make a single one of his or her ideas happen, then for all intents and purposes, the person doesn't exist. nobody has been impacted by any of these ideas.
Right.
And from that perspective, having there's nothing wrong. Sometimes people say it's bad to have a lot of ideas. I completely disagree. There's nothing wrong with having a lot of ideas. What is wrong is not executing any of them.
And you say that one of the ways that you could get the execution, I believe you're saying, is by finding the thread. Is it true? I mean, are you saying find the thread between this idea, see what your interest is, and try to keep everything coming back to that interest?
There are a couple of more things to it. So, yes, you have to find the thread, the connection between these different fields or cultures or whatnot. But there are a couple of things to that. First of all, ask yourself, is this particular thread something that you're passionate about? Do you have a strong interest in it?
Could you give me an example of somebody with disinteresting and interesting threads?
Well, okay, so imagine that, let's just run with this story I started earlier. You go into the newsstand, you pick up a magazine on horseback riding, and you look at it and you get an excellent new idea. Okay, now this idea is great. You get excited about it, you go home, you go to sleep, you wake up, you can barely remember it. And then then you think back and, yeah, okay, that was a pretty good idea. Maybe I should do it. Well, if that's your reaction to it, I would suggest, no, it's a great idea. You may have told somebody about it, but leave it alone. You know when you feel passionate for something. I literally woke up one morning, and I had the idea for my book that morning, and I couldn't shake it. No matter what I did, it was there. It was constantly there. And that's the same held true for my software company, for my healthcare company. I wrote a fiction book back in the day. Same thing. I just couldn't shake this idea. If that's the case, I would say pursue with all your might.
Well, some people can pursue with all their might, and some people can't. I mean, here we are, two shrinks sitting here saying, yeah, you know, you've got the kind of mind that does that. I could see you play sports. I could see you could be directional. I could see that, you know, you're a strong guy. You have a way of going for things that you believe in. But a lot of people I know don't have that capacity. They have ideas. But if you say to them, pick one thing and stick to it, they...
Yeah, I think what I get from the book is that there's sometimes that you get frustrated, and sometimes you really have to just play around with ideas without an immediate result. And I get a sense, it's the flow idea we talked about, creativity, that certain people, and I would think something we want to develop in the people all over, which is they enjoy the creative process. They enjoy not only they're passionate about each of the things that they're doing, they're becoming they enjoy mixing up these ideas, that's playful for them, and even though nothing may come from it, they like brainstorming, they like puzzles, as it were.
Absolutely, and I think that is great, but in the end, the execution piece has to be there. So what you're saying is that some people don't have it in them to focus and to execute, and I think maybe I doubt. Well, you're the expert, so I shouldn't really be stepping in on this territory. But to me, it seems that part of this has to do with what face you're in.
Oh, welcome. We'll learn something for sure. Sure, step on in.
Some of this has to do with what face you're in your life. In other words, a person may be completely incapable, and I have encountered this in my work. Well, since I wrote the book, I've received hundreds, if not thousands, of emails from people all over the world, every continent over the world, on how this has affected them. And they have not been able to find direction. They've not been able to stick to something and execute that. And then when they read this book, it was sort of something went off and said, okay, you know what? I am now at a different place. For whatever reason, it wasn't working out before. And then something, a watershed moment, whether it was a book or not, but something has happened that now makes them say, okay, I'm actually able to focus. I'm going to pick this. I'm going to do this particular thing. And so I'm not as sure that it necessarily has to do with individuals. It may have to do with what stage you are in their life or what phase they're in.
I think that's really important. My guest Franz Johansson, the author of The Medici Effect, and Dr. Kent Robert Shaw with us. I think you've got a really good point there, because let's say you're a 17-year-old adolescent who is being run by your hormones, and all you could see is who's in my bed. And that's all you could see. And meanwhile, somebody's telling you this is a good time to study your calculus. It's a very difficult thing to do. if you're energized by your body. Now, if your chemistry is such that it's not allowing you, do you think that there are chemical components, chemistry in your body that allows you, like, is sufficient dopamine and adrenaline? Do you have to have a certain chemical combination that allows you at that moment to possibly capitalize on your intersections?
I think that's an intriguing question. I can only speculate, but I do believe that many of the actions we take are dictated by the various chemical flows that we have in our body. I mean, it seems apparent that way. Sometimes we're happier about doing things, sometimes we're not. I mean, that alone should tell us that chemistry has an impact. Now, what is it that I hesitate though to just say that is it. Because there's all kinds of reasons why somebody all of a sudden seems to become innovative. You know, take somebody that works for a company and doesn't particularly like their boss or their colleagues, or may like their boss or colleagues but does not like their task. What is it they're doing? They have lots of ideas, but they don't make any of them happen. You can take that exact same person and ask them what they're doing 4 months later, but now they're in a different company. And everything is just happening. Everything is clicking, and their ideas are happening. They have somebody to talk to who's listening to these ideas, and they go ahead and make them happen. It's the exact same person. It's a four-month time lag, but you see this over and over again. And people have told me this, that this desire to innovate has just been something that they felt perhaps held them back, and then something happened. It could have been that they changed their organization, but it could have been something else. And that is what has created this explosion. And that has more to do with the surroundings than perhaps the internal chemistry.
It's interesting always to see the difference. They talked about the difference between Apple Computer's environment and Microsoft environment. You know, and the Microsoft environment is a very loose environment, from what I understand. And the Apple environment was a fairly tight environment, yet both come up with some of the most creative people in the world. And it seems that what you might need at any given time is a particular atmosphere, not that there's one that lends more to creativity than others, because I know IBM is as rigid as you could get, yet within it there is tremendous creativity.
IBM is a fascinating example. You know, they used to be, 10 years ago, they were a hardware company.
Yeah.
Selling hardware, selling computers. And then they moved from that to started selling services, consulting. Now, when I'm out in Detroit and I talk to the big three car companies, I tell them that the equivalent of that in your industry would be if you stopped selling cars. Okay, so IBM is selling computers. They go, okay, well, they move from computers to services, big deal. No, it is a big deal. That's as if, you know, Ford would stop selling cars and started selling the service of cars. And now, incidentally, IBM is realizing the services is becoming commoditized and so on. So they're moving into software. And this is an organization with hundreds of thousands of employees, and yet they're able to make these changes. So size, although size undoubtedly makes something bureaucratic and slower, yes, there's no way around it, it doesn't necessarily stifle you. You can still move.
I think, you know, one of the things you're talking about is one of the great paradoxes, I think, about individuals and creativity is that they are often highly disciplined and highly motivated to learn lots of things and actually master things. And yet armed with that, which again seems to be a very compulsive part of their personality, they then are in harmony with playing with those ideas. And your book even takes it to the next step than what we've done in this series, which is actually play with other ideas, other industries, other concepts, other fields. So it's a playfulness that's even beyond just playing within the ideas that you have. And that paradox within creative people is what is very exciting to think about trying to get in everybody.
Creativity is all about paradox. Creativity is about thinking of 1,000 ideas and selecting one to run with. Creativity is about having the focus, or innovation is about having the focus to make something happen, and yet having the discipline to focus on something to make something happen, and having the openness to look at absolutely everything else for new perspectives. Paradox is at the heart of creativity and innovation.
And I think when you were talking to Armand before about these moments, and it seems like what I read about it is people create their own luck in the sense that there's no magic pill for that aha moment. It seems from reading about the lives of these creative people that they spent hours and hours and days, and many of those ideas go into dead ends, and many of the ideas, and reading about Einstein and Picasso, many of their drawings are creative ideas that went nowhere. But and it's only after the quantity of all these ideas and all these hours that there's some jags of eureka moments.
Absolutely. You know, Pablo Picasso made over 20,000 paintings. 20,000. Most of them are collecting dust in various basements around the world. Why? Because they were no good. Now, this is the nature of all creative individuals. Prince, I talk about Prince briefly in the book. Mm-hmm. He has over 1,000 songs he has not yet released onto the marketplace. Richard Branson sold over 250 companies.
He's a virgin, right?
Yes, virgin. The virgin guy.
Mm-hmm. He's Carlo, not a virgin, but he's a virgin company.
Most definitely not a virgin. George Carl Oates writes books the way, you know, most of us write greeting cards. These people generate a lot of ideas, are not afraid to generate a lot of ideas, and by implication, are not afraid to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. But this is a general principle. In other words, none of us have to be afraid, ultimately, of making mistakes, particularly if we view them as learning.
Right. Yeah, like what stops people from innovating? And one of my guesses is just that two things we just talked about. One is the shame and overwhelming bad feeling when they make human mistakes like Picasso and Einstein and the like and getting through that, as well as the fact that it's not immediately gratifying, that you need to sort of think a long time about these concepts and ideas to have something percolate. And if you're a kind of person that needs immediate gratification, creativity and really, you know, working through creative problems and day after day may not be something that's going to give you an immediate, good, pleasurable feeling, but will have these moments come.
Yeah, well, you know, part of a problem with that, Kent, is when a person suddenly decides, I'm going to do my creative thing and I'm going to quit my job and write my book. Mm-hmm. And now the pressure of every page is that dollar rent that's going to come due. And so when the pressure gets on you and you have the pressure and you don't have a backup of any kind and you try to do a creative endeavor, you don't have that choice of throwing away the failures. Each failure has much more meaning.
Yes. That is certainly true. And yet, the people that break through, they will still make these mistakes. They will still make these mistakes. You know, I go back to my own experience. I don't talk about my own experience in the book because I did so much research with other people. But I can talk about it here. You know, at one point when I was writing this, I was literally down to my last $2.45. It was a bit rough. You know, you live in New York, and I can't an immense amount of credit card at that particular time to write this book. But there was no failures involved. It was just experimentation. You know, you write a chapter and it doesn't work. Okay, so then you have to rewrite it, or you come up with another way. There's a particular logic to this that for some reason doesn't work. Okay, I need to go back and do some more research. That was the process, and in the end, something came out that was good, and it was a process of experimentation. When I was done with my book, I had 100,000 words written. And in the final edition that you can buy in the store, it's 62,000 words. So that's 38,000 words that I spent coming up with stuff that ultimately went nowhere. You still have to be prepared for that. Now, the fewer mistakes you're willing to make, the closer you're going to stick to the already known. So that's fine. Okay, you don't want to make any mistakes. That's okay. That's okay. You know, as I said, you know, you have a Big Mac and you decide to add another leaf of lettuce. You know, it's okay. Like, the risk of that failing is not tremendous, but it's also not going to significantly change what it is that you do.
You know, this is Armand DeMille. We're with Kent Robichaud and Franz Johansson. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back to you, a little music and then continuing with the Medici effect. That's Tony Scott with Hare Krishna. Remember Hare Krishna? There was an idea. It worked. I get lost in that. Hey, here we are on WBAI 99.5 FM, if you've just tuned by to the Hare Krishna of Tony Scott. We're talking about creativity, dynamic creativity, explosive creativity, the kind of creativity that comes out of thousands of years of culture and genetics and things that have kind of led us to where we are today. And our guest is Franz Johansson, who has written a small book called The Medici Effect, which focuses on the Medicis in Florence and how that whole world of intersectional thinking led to a bulge in creativity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, New York today, they think, is just that kind of place. It's not mentioned in your book, but my understanding is a hundred years ago in New York, you had an Irish immigrant who was doing clog dancing, and you had some slaves who had come from the South, and they were here in New York, and they had African dance, and they actually combined together to produce tap dance. That's the origins of tap dance, is actually these two divergent cultures coming together. And you talk in the book about a chef and people who are, again, using, you know, staying out of their genre or their comfort zone and exploring the different cultures and different ideas that come together here.
Yes, it is. That is the single biggest, I think, factor in what is happening in this term globalization. There's a lot of things that are included in that, but the merging of different cultures, people from different ethnicities, different gender, and so on, is tremendous, and it has led to an incredible amount of innovation. And remarkably, most companies are not actually actively pursuing these types of intersections. But the ones that do are constantly on the brink of something new, fascinating. And you can just look at them and you can say, okay, IBM that I mentioned earlier is one of those companies. They've done a very, very good job of bringing in together people from different countries, ethnicities, cultures, and so on. And you mentioned a chef. Yeah, I talk about a chef in the book. Actually, someone from this city, from New York, Marcus Samuelson. He's the executive chef of Aquavit. When he was 24 years old, he became the youngest chef ever to receive the 3-star rating from the New York Times. And the question at that time was, how did he do that? Now, he was a Swedish chef. But could he have been the best chef ever to be cooking Swedish food at the age of 24? You know that the answer to that has to be no. What he did instead was he looked at what he knew. He looked at his experience, and he combined it with ingredients and cooking techniques from all over the world and broke new ground and created a wonderful new cuisine. Incredible, really. Now, why was he able to do that? Why was he so able to do that? Turns out that he was born in Ethiopia, and then he was adopted into Sweden, and then he learned how to cook in Austria, Switzerland, France, and all over the world. He brought all that knowledge with him here to New York, yes, a sort of a modern-day Florence, if you will, and made all of those ideas happen.
Yeah, and in it, he's sort of asked questions, this chef, and I know, as we were talking about ways to break through that creativity barrier, and he's somebody, I think in the book, when he's heard about Caesar salad, he goes, Caesar salad soup. So that's where he goes to, these two seemingly disjointed ideas, and that's going to probably play with his head for hours or days, and out of that Caesar salad soup may come a genius sort of innovative recipe.
Sounds yummy. It actually sounds interesting, Caesar salad soup, don't you think? Listen, but you know, here's where it boils down to. When we talk about creativity, we get down to one element. And the only element that ever makes creativity work, other than luck and being discovered by somebody who has a great deal of discipline, who could line up all your ducks. So if you have a creative idea, and somebody comes along and says, oh, what a great voice you have, you're a great singer, I will organize you, I will book you, I'll set you up, then you could possibly be very successful. But if you don't have an organizer and you don't have that discipline and you don't have that ability, there is no way to do it. You know, without discipline, either from intrinsic or extrinsic, you can't get an idea to work. I mean, how did you got your idea to work? But you have people who did this for you as well, right, Franz?
I did this all on my own.
And you have a sense of organization.
But yes, I think that in my particular case, I can sort of like a pendulum swing between complete chaos and an explosion of ideas all over the place in a million different directions, and then honing in and executing, and then going back and forth between those two, maybe even on a daily basis. But what I was going to say is that you're right. Say that you don't have that. Well, then teaming up with someone that has it is critical. And in fact, it is the way many people have done it. Some people would argue, I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, that John Lennon and Paul McCartney had sort of that type of relationship. One who just came up with tons and tons of ideas, another who sort of focused in and looked at the business piece of it and said, okay, how do we actually bring this together? How do we make it happen? And so I think that is another component to it. If it's not intrinsic, as you said, it has to be extrinsic. But if it's not neither one of those things, forget about it. Then you just have a bunch of ideas.
And well, you know, one of the problems is when a person who is creative decides that they're going to get together with somebody who is, quote, a business person, they feel that the business person is stifling their creativity. And there's got to be an understanding. You know, just like when couples meet each other and a man and a woman get together and they're both different and they get married, and one says, hey, you're stifling my creativity, and the other one says, yes, but somebody has to take out the garbage. This is the way it manifests. This is the way a marriage turns into a great thing. So number one, it's to value that the other side of you, which you don't have, which is your discipline and your that's going to be necessary, number one, and you have to value that. And you have to give that a lot of room. And the other thing that you need to do is to see if you could find an area inside yourself where even though you are not disciplined, there is a place where you're very disciplined. And this is a very good thing I find with people. In working with clients who feel that they can't possibly move forward, I will find something as small as how they pick their clothing and how they put on their clothing and what structure they use. And I will take the very structure that they use for anything. It could be in hobbies, especially in hobbies. People have it. How do you line it up in your hobby? How do you choose the music? Where do you put the albums? How do you categorize the albums? By finding what they do and how they do it, I ask them to try to use that as an application to their creative process.
Now, that's a great idea, phenomenal idea.
Innovative.
Innovative and intersectional on top of it. One thing I wanted to mention in relation to that is that oftentimes when one talks about creativity and innovation, we take it from that end, that the person that has all these ideas but can't make them happen. But it is equally, and I literally mean this, equally important to look at the person that all this person can do is being disciplined and execute, and that's it. But it's completely unable to bring in any new type of idea into their life, which basically sets this person up for oftentimes an incredibly stifling situation. There they are, and they're just moving forward, and they're moving forward perhaps fast, but towards what?
Yeah, I see that a lot with people who play piano. You know, I do. They play piano and they can play the same piece over and over again perfectly. And because they play that same piece over and over again perfectly, they can't move outside of that piece. You're like that, aren't you?
I resemble that comment.
You resemble that comment.
No, I'm learning some new hip songs because...
That's right. That's what you do. You move outside of jazz.
I have a new muse, so I'm trying to move outside of jazz, get pop into it. And this aspect of music, there's a great... Because I think this may be a little hard for people to understand intersection. One of the parts of the book I thought was really nice was talking about tubular bells and how you can, if you're combining not just rock and classical, there's so many more combinations available. And that may be a very simple example to show people what we're talking about. Could you explain what came up with the origin of the tubular bells?
Yes. I mentioned Richard Branson earlier, and I did that in the context of that many ideas is critical to come up with something good. And you see this among innovators all over the world. Now, if you look at Richard Branson's story, it's quite fascinating. When he started Virgin Records about 30 years ago, he actually lost money on every single artist he signed on for the first 5 years, except for the very first one, who was Mike Oldfield. And Mike Oldfield came up with his unique album called Tubular Bells. And it was a completely unique mixture of rock music and classical music. And once it hit the market, it sat on the number one spot in the UK for 15 straight months. Now, why did I use that as an example? It proves another important point to Tubular Bells piece, which is that imagine for a moment that you are within just one field, say rock music. You're a rock musician, and you try to change that field a little bit. Well, rock music is a pretty defined form of music, particularly during those days. You know, there's only a couple of instruments you really have to work with. You can only have a bass and a guitar and a drum set. These are the things, instruments you need for a rock band. And so you're fairly limited in the number of idea combinations. You can mix perhaps some structures and some vocals and so on, but it's fairly limiting. And if you look at classical music, that's also fairly limiting. Yeah, you have a lot of instruments, but you have almost no choice in terms of vocals. You may have a choir or not. So you have these two, a classical composer and a rock musician, and they're fairly limited in the number of ideas that they can dig from. But then if you combine them, if you step into the intersection of these two fields, then all of a sudden, the number of ideas increases exponentially. In the example that I give in the book, I say that in each one of these fields, rock music and classical music, you have 2,400 ideas available. But at the intersection of them, when you combine these two fields, you have close to 6 million ideas available to you. And it just gives you a tremendous advantage. That's the reason why Prince comes up with 1,000 songs. That's the reason why Pablo Picasso does over 20,000 paintings. That's the reason Richard Branson started over 250 companies.
So finding your spot, you know, one of the reasons why it really pays to listen to your mate is because sometimes they have an experience. You know, I mean, even though you may think that what they have to say is boring, what'd you do today? I went shopping. You know, listen to the process. Listen to it. Listen to a step-by-step of that shopping process and watch it open your world. You know, people tend to do that very thing that you're talking about, tend to isolate and disallow anything that doesn't fall in our field. Therefore, what a foolish idea. But, gee, children can teach you a tremendous amount about creativity. You know, I can't get over watching a child or a kitten play with a box. You know, the container means just as much as the thing inside it. So this is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robertshaw. We're talking to Franz Johansson. Franz, we're not going to get away without you talking about elephants and epidemics. We need to know how elephants and epidemics affect and what they can teach us about innovation.
Yeah, both of those examples about the elephants and epidemics come up in the book when I talk about risk. And I talk about risk in the perspective of that there's a lot of traps that we encounter as individuals when we try to do something new, when we try to do something innovative. It could be that we feel locked in to our own field, ignoring the fact that this field might disappear. You know, if you're in the mid-90s and you're in the CD industry and you want to be the king of that industry and you have a strategy for doing that, that's great. You can be innovating that all you want. But 10 years later, you're dead. So that's one of the traps. I'll talk about some of those traps. And in doing that, I use an example of an elephant to show that our notion of risk is not rational. It's a funny story. It goes back to the Second World War and Moscow's being bombed, basically, by Hitler's forces. And this very famous statistician who says that, I'm not going to go to a bomb shelter. The risk of getting hit by a bomb is so low that there's no point in going. There's 6 million people in Moscow. Why would they hit me? And then a couple of days later, he showed up in the bomb shelter. People said, what are you doing here? You said there's no risk. Well, he said, there's 6 million people and one elephant in Moscow. And last night they hit the elephant. So I'm here. The way we think about risk is not rational. And so this piece about elephant, the elephant story is really meant to show that. And the epidemic story came right on the heels of that to show once again that the way we think about risk is not rational. It's a bit too complicated to go through on the air, but the interesting thing is that in the book, I lay up this example of how would we respond with a vaccine in a particular epidemic? Would we go for a riskier approach, seemingly a riskier approach or not? And it turns out that the way we phrase the question dramatically changes our response to it, even though the situation is the same. So if I tell you that, are you going out to save 400 lives, or are you going out to kill out of 600, or are you going out to kill or let 200 people die out of 600? Well, the net result of those two is exactly the same. 200 people will die and 400 people will live. But the way you phrase that question dramatically changes how people view the risks of the situation. And you know, that is the way it works in real life. If somebody tells you, in words that you've seen, that, oh, you work in retail, you're selling clothing, and somebody talks to you about those risks that you recognize, you feel comfortable. Oh, this is something that is not risky. I know about this industry, just as you could have in the CD industry, mid-90s. Oh, I know about everything. I'm very comfortable around this. In truth, you're really deluding yourself, because you're actually listening to the words used and the comfort around those words.
Again, I think that the aspect of risk is really gets to the paradox, another paradox of creativity, not just about discipline and play, but also about self-preservation. That, again, the idea of trying to do something that's familiar is safe. Doing the way it's been done before is safe. And obviously there's a big part of human nature like that, to go the safe route, where there's hopefully in many of us cultivated an idea of doing something different, something creative, something playful, something risky, with the idea that it may not be safe. It may be a big flop. It may be I may waste money doing this. So I think those two different forces about familiar and safety versus risk, with the risk of something going badly for you. Because theorists have talked about fear growth, that every growth process you have to take a risk.
Yeah, but Kent Roberts, sure, you have a medical degree. I mean, you've got an MD, you've got a full practice as a psychiatrist. Now you say, okay, now I'll take some risks. But, you know, you set it up so that you could take it, you could live your life in that kind of way. Many people I know who are stopping themselves from being successful, they need to stop taking risks. There's a few people I know that if I were to say, what's your road to your creative success? Get a job. You know, remember that old song? Get a job. Do, 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 do. Get a job. Get a job, because you've got to learn somewhere discipline. And if you're going to learn that discipline by being at a job and showing up every day and getting a salary, it's going to give you that added piece that you need. So I think that there are many people out there who always take risks and never take the road, the bigger risk, which is discipline.
Right.
Which is that discipline, which may be the direction to go, as opposed to adding more risk. The other question I have is about failure and the fear of failure. And this I know that you've done some work on. What do you think? How do you think the fear of failure, Franz, affects people in their desire to reach out in this intersectional way?
Well, the first...
I'm an intersectionalist. Sounds like a fetish.
A good one. In that case, yeah, the fear of failure, I think, is very interesting, because what people tend to fear more is failure and not what is at stake. Let me give you an example. You can have an executive at a large company that manages millions of dollars, a $10 million budget, and they make decisions, you know, $500,000 this way, $1 million that way, and they can do that without really thinking too much about it. And then they go home, and they're supposed to have a dinner for their colleagues at work, and they're the ones to cook. Now, are they going to do a dish that they know very, very well, or are they going to try something new? A ton of them are going to do something that they've done over and over again before, because they know that it works. They're not willing to risk that this dinner is not going to taste perfect. And yet, what are the stakes? The stakes are just a dinner that perhaps tastes a little bit less than perfect. I mean, the stakes are not that big. What we fear is failure, not what is at stake. We fear is the loss of prestige. It's the status. It's the fact. It's self-confidence. The hit towards self-confidence that we fear. And I believe that there's a number of different ways to get around it. One is to try to hold true. It's not failure, it's learning. That may be scant hope for some people, but it is that is true. The other piece is understanding that you have to do something new. You have to come up with something different. And when you do that, you have to head into unknown territory. You're going into unknown territory. Sometimes you're going to end up in a few blind spots, dead ends. We accept it when we're in a city. We accept it when we try to find our way through a city. We should accept it in our life as well.
Well, you know, being crushed. I mean, I know enough people who believe that, you know, they get on American Idol and they've been singing in their basement for years and then they think they're great and then they get up on American Idol and Simon Cowell says, "Yeesh, you shouldn't even be up here." You can get crushed. And I believe being crushed and coming through it like the phoenix has also got great value. I think, you know, sure, get depressed. Sure, you know, let yourself quit and give up on everything. That makes a lot of sense to me, that it's not so terrible. You shouldn't just deny it, that there's something to it that's also got value.
I think that is true. Just back in my own life, when I had a software company, that was during the dot-com boom, and I can hear the Tubular Bells in the background.
How do you like that?
This tune is great. Some of the listeners will probably remember The Exorcist. Yes. That was how it became popular in the States.
Yeah, well, listen, Franz, I wish we could continue, and we will, because Franz Johansson is so creative that he winds up staying in Brooklyn and Manhattan and all over the place, and we can get him back here, and we can get Kent Robert Shaw back, and Jonna for sure will be back. Mike Oldfield, who knows where he is nowadays, but he did give us Tubular Bells, which you're all listening to. We'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends. This has been great. The name of the book, The Medici Effect, M-E-D-I-C-I Effect, Franz Johansson. Be back with you on Tuesday. If you want to get a copy of today's show or listen to it or send it to a friend, go to thepositivemind.com.